This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
And while we're on the subject, Brent recorded a video from Eilat this week from right there on the Red Sea. It's a 20-minute explainer about what Iran has been up to. That is available at the front page of thetrumpet.com. I would encourage you to go check that out. A really excellent and thorough analysis of what has been happening there. Thank you for that, Brent. We're going to start with Brent talking about U.S. President Joe Biden and the agenda that he is enacting that is far more radical than anything that anyone expected him to. You can see it in his approach to immigration and gun control, race, economic policy, many other issues. We have a couple of stories at the beginning of today's program talking about steps announced this week regarding foreign policy and about the future of the Supreme Court. And we're going to start by looking at President Biden's pledge to withdraw troops from Afghanistan this year unconditionally. For this, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, this is obviously a story that's been a long time coming, given that American troops have been in Afghanistan for 20 years. It seems like the September 11th terrorist attacks weren't that long ago, but it's been 20 years. And this, the response to that attack was sending U.S. forces to attack al-Qaeda and remove the Taliban from power. Taliban ruling over part of Afghanistan, giving al-Qaeda safe haven. And President Biden has said that these troops are now going to come home. Of course, there's been previous presidents that have said that that was their goal. However, no previous president has said that there would be an unconditional retreat from Afghanistan. And that's the big change with President Biden's decision. By September 11th this year, all American forces will be out of that country. And right now there's about 2,500 troops there, including some intelligence gathering troops. And so President Trump, he had conditioned a removal of U.S. forces based on some type of peace arrangement with the Taliban. And we came down pretty hard on that, showing that it was a massive sign of weakness that the Trump administration would be willing to negotiate with the Taliban, the very people that America went in there to remove from power. However, he did have a conditions-based removal of U.S. forces. Now, President Biden has decided that doesn't matter what happens between now and then, we are bringing the troops home.
What is the concern over how this could affect conditions in Afghanistan for the United States to leave?
Well, there's numerous concerns. One would be for the United States security. Al-Qaeda is still active in Afghanistan, and if the U.S. leaves, there's going to obviously be a strengthening of Al-Qaeda and under the umbrella of the Taliban. The Taliban still rules over much of the country right now. And so a return to Taliban rule is all but assured. And so you have the loss of American servicemen on the ground that can gather intelligence upon what Al-Qaeda is planning. That is the big point for the United States about what they would lose in terms of intelligence gathering. The big point for Afghanistan is that this means a retreat back to Sharia law governing their state. Before this, and Mr. Zekic, author for thetrumpet.com, he's written an article about this. He brings attention to this to show how there would be a great backtrack in freedoms among the Afghani people when the United States leaves, because there is no longer United States servicemen there that can hold back the Taliban ruling in a way that will put down women. And women going to school, even. I think that before America went in there, there were no women, girls going to school. And I think there was 900,000 boys. And now that number is up to 9 million children being educated in the education system, 3.5 million of those girls. That's going to stop. That's just one example. And so the Afghanis are very fearful of the United States leaving. Yes, they have 2,500 servicemen. It doesn't seem like a massive footprint. But if you kill a U.S. serviceman that is embedded with Afghani troops, that holds a lot of weight. And the Taliban is very cautious about acting in that way. And so there aren't a lot of benefits for a United States withdrawal. However, you can also understand the reasoning of this forever war that's gone on for 20 years without any successful conclusion.
Right. Well, that's the point, isn't it? A 20-year war, the longest war in American history, a whole lot of blood and treasure spent here, and the United States pulls out, and essentially Afghanistan is back to where it was at the very beginning. And this is prophetic.
Yeah, that's right. And we've written this up. We have a trend article that Mihailo Zekic draws attention to in his article, America Has Won Its Last War, showcasing this prophecy that was made by Herbert W. Armstrong decades ago that the United States is not going to have a successful military war and come out victorious. And this is what we said was going to happen. Mr. Gerald Flory wrote as such back in 2001 when American servicemen went in, that America will not win this war against a ragtag bunch of, just comparing the power of the United States military to that of the Taliban, there's a massive discrepancy in power. And yet the Bible says that in this time, in the latter days, that America's will is going to be broken and will be unable to use that power successfully in warfare. And so this is what was prophesied to happen 20 years ago. We're watching the fulfillment right now as America not only negotiates its surrender. That's what President Trump was doing. Now there's no negotiation over it. There's just surrender. And President Biden, in his announcement that the troops come back by September 11th, and I don't know why you would choose that date as well. It's a symbol of failure now that they went in the aftermath of that, of those attacks, and it's just showcasing the failure of the United States to change a single thing. And so if people want to understand more of the prophetic underpinnings for why we could have made a forecast 20 years ago that this was going to be unsuccessful, I do recommend reading that article.
All right, and we also have that article by Mihailo Zekic, Biden's Message to the Taliban, You Won, both of those available at thetrumpet.com. Mihailo's on the front page, the other under the trends section, both under the links to today's program. Thank you for that, Brent. Now to the Supreme Court. President Biden announced that he'll form a presidential commission to consider changes to the court. Congressional Democrats immediately introduced a bill aimed at radically transforming the court. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, as you mentioned, President Biden signed an executive order making a commission just to study in the pros and cons of increasing the number of justices on the Supreme Court. But those radical Democrats in Congress immediately put in a bill proposing that we increase the number of justices from 9 to 13. So it would add, this bill would add 4 justices to the Supreme Court, which, according to the calculus, since it's early in the Biden administration, Joe Biden could just appoint those 4 justices, and you'd have 4 more liberal activist justices on the Supreme Court, which would tilt the balance from, well, right now, depending on how you classify John Roberts, it's ostensibly 6 conservatives to 3 liberals. But then if you add in 4 more, it'd be 6 conservatives to 7 or 8 liberals. So big change. Now, granted, this isn't likely, at least the bill isn't likely to pass. The commission's being established, but Joe Biden has said that he just wanted the commission. He's not supporting the bill right now. Nancy Pelosi said she's not going to let this bill come to a vote. Even if she did let this bill come to a vote, she would need every Democrat to support it, and there's a few more moderate Democrats who are not on board with increasing the size of the Supreme Court. And even if you could get them on board, you'd need to do away with the filibuster in order to keep the Republicans from blocking it. So a radical bill, not likely to pass, but that doesn't mean it's not significant. Actually, Andrew McCarthy had a piece where he pointed out that Franklin Roosevelt kind of did the same thing in the 30s when he was trying to get the New Deal through Congress. As he keep trying to push in this New Deal, the Supreme Court keeps shooting it down as unconstitutional. He threatened to pack the court, increase the size of the court, so he could get more liberal justices who would rule it is constitutional. Now, he couldn't get the support to make that happen, but just the threat of it basically cowed the Supreme Court into submission on that issue, and they decided to let him do a lot of the radical New Deal proposals that he wanted to. So Andrew McCarthy was saying that this is likely what the Biden administration has in mind, and Senate Minority Mitch McConnell agrees with him on that point. Right before the bill was introduced, he said that he thought that it wasn't going to pass, but it's really it's aimed to be a sword dangling over the justices on every future case they weigh. So now if you have a controversial case come up, like Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett and Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas probably wouldn't care, but they just know. They know that, okay, if they make a too controversial decision, that you might anger the Democrats into really trying to get this bill to pass. So that, which would have an effect on the future decisions by moderating, you'll get more moderate conservatives siding with the liberal wing if they don't want the Biden administration to push this through. It's more of a blackmail move than a sincere effort, at least for now.
It hardly seems like they need to do that in order to sway the votes of some of these supposedly conservative justices, John Roberts being probably at the head of the pack. It seems like they've been fairly compliant with Democrats in not doing anything that would upset them.
Right, yeah, because Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito have been pretty steadfast conservatives. John Roberts is basically, I almost count him as a progressive justice by this point.
Yeah, the fact that you have these Democrats that are, they're talking about it like it's a 6-3 conservative majority, but the way that the court rules in so many cases, it's hardly favorable to conservatives, the way that they would characterize it.
Yeah, when you look at like who appointed the justices, a Republican or a Democrat, it looks like it's 6-3. But when you actually look at the rulings coming out of the court, it's 50-50, if that. It might even be leaning slightly towards the liberals.
So it does seem like the way that some of these Democrats are operating, not all of them, but they are certainly not afraid to show their hand. I mean, Joe Biden has been fairly forthcoming with some of the radical agenda that he's been promoting. This commission, he's kind of playing coy and acting like he's not supporting court packing. The other Democrats, they're just coming right out there and doing it. For the most part, you see just a whole lot more willingness to be very forthcoming with just how radical they want to move the country.
Yeah, and definitely there's even some political calculus in keeping the Democratic Party unified, because something like this, it might be more of a shot across the bow to Republicans, but you almost have to. They almost had to introduce this this court packing bill just to keep like the Bernie Sanders AOC wing of the Democratic Party happy, because there's like at least.
They'll never be happy.
At least half of Democrats are really angry right now at how conservative Joe Biden is.
Yeah, trying to appease this group is an impossible task. But Gerald Fleury has been writing about just some of the problems in America's justice system as it stands right now. This would constitute an even further move away from the principles of the rule of law and application of the Constitution.
Right. Well, even we weren't even talking about conservative justices ruling in a liberal way. It was right after December 7th they introduced that court case to potentially overturn the results of the presidential election by pointing out that there were four attorney generals who changed their state's election laws like the week before the election unilaterally, which is completely unconstitutional and unfair to the Trump campaign. And so that went to the Supreme Court, and it was only Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito who even wanted to hear the evidence. All the progressive justices and the, like, four of the allegedly conservative justices threw that out. And so it was right shortly after that that Mr. Fleury wrote his article, America's Broken Judgment, and then the subtitle for that is Corrupt Courts Are a Nation-Destroying Problem. And he drew attention in the introduction to just some of the corruption in the courts in regards to the election crisis, but then quickly showed how this is prophetic, going through numerous scriptures in quite a bit of detail in both Micah and Hosea about Israel being broken in judgment and the justices oppressing the people. Just the you read through both those books, and you just get this picture of like this just justice system that's rotten to the core. And you are really seeing that in America today, where, like I said, at least half the justices, if not more, don't make judgments based on justice or law. They make judgments based on political agenda. And even amongst those justices who would like to make decisions based on judgment and law, you're seeing things like this where they're holding back or backing down out of cowardice is probably the best word for it, because they figure it's like, well, if I make a just decision, the Biden administration will pack the court, put in four liberal justices, and we'll be worse off then than we are now.
Well, an excellent article by Gerald Fleury, America's Broken Judgment. There's a whole lot there that explains God's view of what is happening to America's justice system. You can read that article at thetrumpet.com. And thank you very much, Andrew. Now over to Austria, where an investigation has exposed serious wrongdoing on the part of a chancellor in whom a lot of people had placed their hope and trust. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I think this is a fascinating piece. I mean, we've had in the U.S. 4 years of Democrats saying that the U.S. administration has been violating democratic norms and turning America into a dictatorship. I mean, we even heard that in some of the Democratic pronouncements about this court packing that Andrew just talked about. You know, we need to do this because Donald Trump has been destroying democracy. And because of that, I think it can be easy to ignore some of the democratic decline that is genuinely going on in Eastern Europe and that we've seen happening in Austria, in Poland, in Hungary. You know, especially in Hungary, we've seen Viktor Orban grabbing control of all kinds of institutions. And you know what happens when you do that, when you get rid of democracy? You attack the press. You get control of the media. Something, you know, I don't think anybody, even the most radical liberal, could say that Donald Trump had the media on his side. But anyway, what we've seen, I think, over the last week or so is some really revealing reports showing that this trend is crossing over from Eastern Europe into the West now, using that traditional bridge between East and West that is Austria. So Politico had Politico Europe, they had a big cover article exposing some of what has been going on with Sebastian Kurz. They start their article by saying, Sebastian Kurz, a political wunderkind who became Austria's leader at just 31, rose to power by cultivating a youthful do-gooder image that endeared him to young and old alike. And then he went rogue. And what this investigative report goes through is Kurz behaving in a way that's fairly similar to someone like Viktor Orban, or these Eastern European strongmen, where he has it's based on a whole bunch of private text messages, and basically showing him behind the scenes kind of strong-arming different figures, whether it's figures in the media, figures even in the Catholic Church, if the Catholic Church criticized him, you know, working hard to make sure that pressure was applied so that those figures wouldn't. And it's a very different image to the kind of very polished image that we've been seeing from the public face of Kurz.
So we've been talking about this trend toward strongman leadership in Europe for quite some time, and in some ways, I guess you expect this to some degree in these Eastern European countries. To see this happening in Austria is somewhat earth-shaking, I guess, to people who want to view Europe as this repository of all things democratic and so on. But that's not what Bible prophecy says Europe is going to look like. And what we see in Austria is much closer to what we've been forecasting based on those prophecies.
Right. And this is why we've been watching this trend in Eastern Europe, where the way that these strongmen have been operating is very similar to what we've been forecasting, very similar to what the Bible talks about. They are they're kind of fairly autocratic. There's still some democracy. They're not complete dictators. But then they tend to have a strong partnership with the Catholic Church as well. Even someone like Viktor Orban, who himself is not a Catholic, has worked very closely with the Catholic Church and really made this kind of religious man, religious figure, with the support of the church, a key part of his persona. And this is exactly what the Bible talks about as coming for Europe. Revelation chapter 13, I mean, it's chapter 17, sorry. It talks about a Europe led by kings, Europe led by strongmen that form a partnership with a woman, or in Bible prophecy, that's a church. So we've been seeing this in Eastern Europe and saying, well, look, this is showing the way. This is what the future of all of Europe is going to look like. And then when you see Austria going further and further down that path, I mean, when we've been writing on this 2-3 years ago, I think there were already signs that Kurz was heading in this direction. So Kurz prioritized his relationship with Archbishop Schönborn, prioritized his relationship with the Catholic Church. You saw him really centralizing authority within the party and within Austrian government around himself. So you saw a lot of these tendencies. But now to see him kind of breaking those democratic norms in exactly the same way as those people in the East, it shows this trend is spreading throughout Europe. It's not just a post-Soviet phenomenon. It's something that is having an impact all across. And once it spreads to Austria, well, Austria, as we have an article coming up soon by Joshua Michels, he talks about how close Kurz is to Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg and Germany's Christian Social Union Party. You can start to see this trend very easily spreading from Germany from Austria into Germany and playing a major role in all of Europe. And that is exactly what the Bible talks about. And we have a book on this. Well, we talked about this trend of Eastern leaders in the 2018, the January 2018 Trumpet print edition, introducing Europe's Eastern strongmen. But then we talk about what the Bible prophesies for this future in our book, A Strong German Leader is Imminent.
All right. Very, very good. Watch for that article from Josue Michels, as well as those other two articles that that Richard talked about there, introducing Europe's Eastern strongmen and A Strong German Leader is Imminent. We'll link to all of those in the show notes for today's program. Thanks for that, Richard. We've been keeping our eye on Russia's military buildup near Ukraine. Well, that continued this week. To learn about the latest, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, this situation has only grown more combustible since last week. Estimates say that now there are around 100,000 Russian troops that are now deployed both in Crimea and also near the Donbass region in the east of Ukraine. And then the most recent assault vehicles that have been sent there are painted with what's called invasion stripes. So this is a pattern that they use for vehicles intended for the very first pushes into another nation's territory, because the stripes help prevent friendly fire. They show, you know, the Russian soldiers still back on the Russian side that these are fellow Russians. So the deployment of those vehicles painted with these invasion stripes it's really caused quite a stir. It's also estimated that Russia now has about 1,300 battle tanks, 3,700 drones and 1,300 artillery and mortar units deployed, and then also close to 400 multiple launch rocket systems. So just an extraordinary amount of firepower. And then to go along with that, there have also been reports of Russian officials threatening to, quote, end Ukraine this week. So it's very tense. And last week we spoke about some warships that the U.S. was planning to send to the Black Sea. The big news this week is that that's off. The Biden administration apparently canceled those plans in an attempt to kind of de-escalate the situation. And then we also had President Biden call Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday, and he offered him the carrot of a bilateral summit. So that's, you know, a head seat at the world's most important negotiating table. That's something that Putin craves quite a lot, just as kind of proof that Russia is an important nation. So those are some big carrots from the U.S., but it's unclear whether these kinds of moves will de-escalate the situation or if they'll just be viewed by Putin as signs of weakness that could maybe make him even more inclined to invade. So it remains very tense, and Dmitry Trinin, the head of the Moscow Carnegie Center, talked about it all this week, and he said, "Let's face it, regional war in Europe is again thought of as a possibility on both sides. Fasten your seatbelts."
So the United States certainly has signaled that it doesn't want any kind of a confrontation with Russia. If Russia were to go ahead and make a move here, it seems like that's definitely what President Putin is banking on. And this isn't the only theater where the United States is facing a potential conflict. It seems like we've been talking about how there are other powers that are kind of using this moment with Joe Biden in power to ramp up their own agendas.
Yes. Yeah, that's a big part of this story that not many analysts are discussing. But at the same time that Putin is amassing all these troops near Ukraine, his number one comrade in crime, Chinese President Xi Jinping, is simultaneously ramping up military aggression against Taiwan to a really alarming degree. On Monday, a record was broken when China sent 25 warplanes into Taiwan's air defense identification zone. That was the largest incursion in history for China. The previous record had actually been set just a month earlier when China flew 20 warplanes through Taiwan's airspace. But now we've already got a new record set with 25. And then all this activity in the skies there is happening during a time of increasing maritime incursions as well, with Chinese warships trespassing into Taiwanese waters. So what I think is just really interesting here is that Russia and China seem to be almost coordinating all of this adventurism. And if they were to synchronize their invasions, you know, Russia and Ukraine and then China and Taiwan, that would greatly complicate any kind of response by the U.S. The U.S. still has the world's largest and most powerful military, but there was a report by the Heritage Foundation back in 2019, and it said, yes, the U.S. military would be able to handle itself adequately in a single major regional conflict, but if a second conflict erupted at the same time, America would have serious problems. It would just be stretched very thin. So to know about that reality for the U.S. military and then to see Russia and China both beating war drums right now at the same time, I think it just shows how fragile the global peace may be.
So how do you view this from a prophetic perspective?
Well, we know from Bible prophecy, especially passages in the books of Ezekiel and Daniel and Revelation, that Russia and China are going to play a central role in the next world war. The Bible shows that they will be allied together for that war, and they'll lead an Asian superpower that will be destructive almost beyond imagination. Revelation 9:15 says that this power will actually take out one-third of the global population. So just unfathomable destruction there. So, you know, it's hard to say right now what will happen with Ukraine and what will happen with Taiwan in the next few weeks or months. But we do know that ultimately Russia and China will make war and it'll unleash devastation on a scale that's far beyond anything in history.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Anywhere that you would send listeners if they want more information?
Yes. For an overview of those scriptures, I would recommend our free booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy.
All right. Well, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Iran enriching uranium to its highest level ever, the race to become the successor to German Chancellor Angela Merkel, more race riots in America, and China stealing American technology. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
An Iranian official announced that his nation has enriched uranium to its highest level ever. To learn about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this week it was very busy on the Iranian nuclear front. On Thursday, the world powers were again meeting in Vienna to continue nuclear talks. And just a day earlier, the Iranians said that they had started enriching. Well, they were about to start enriching to 60% purity uranium. This is the highest level they've ever attained, at least overtly, and declared as such. Their centrifuges started producing this high purity uranium on Friday night at midnight is when they first produced their first amount of this. And for people's understanding, only 35% is needed for any type of civilian nuclear power plant or civilian purpose. But now Iran has upped the ante all the way to 60%, just shy of the 90% mark that's needed for a nuclear weapon. Now, so this was such a drastic move that even the Europeans came out with this statement. This is France, Germany, and the United Kingdom. They said, quote, "This is a serious development since the production of highly enriched uranium constitutes an important step in the production of a nuclear weapon. Iran has no credible civilian need for enrichment at this level." And so really, this is an absolute, we should be a wake-up call to everybody that has bought into the narrative that Iran does not desire a nuclear weapon, because there is absolutely no functionality for the Iranians to produce 60% uranium unless they are moving towards 90%, the necessary purity to have a nuclear bomb.
So he makes this announcement just days after the Natanz nuclear facility was attacked, presumably by Israel. Talk about just the timing of this.
Yeah, this is a report that came out on Sunday night, and that was reported first from the New York Times, where a blast was experienced at the Natanz nuclear development facility, where they're actually purifying uranium to this great degree. This is actually a place where they do have an underground facility as well. And everyone points to Israel. Even the Iranians broke with their way of talking and actually admitted to the attack. It cut off the main power supply to the Natanz facility and its backup. And so no one really knows how Israel was so successful at doing this. However, the Iranians said that Israel was doing it to try and destabilize the talks, to try and reduce the leverage that Iran had over America, over the West, by negating their nuclear capabilities, by destroying this Natanz facility. And there's been disagreement on how much damage it actually took, this attack. However, Iran then decides that to actually increase their negotiating power over the world powers, that they're going to start enriching to 60%. So whether the Iranians would have done it if Israel attacked or not, who knows? However, this does, as I said before, really show the fact that Israel feels the need to attack this nuclear facility, because Israel's worried that Iran is going to get the bomb. If they don't have it already, Israel is definitely worried about that. And to the point that Iran feels like it's going to be beneficial for nuclear talks to show that it has the ability to race towards a nuclear weapon. Now, it should be shocking that there are still European nations and the United States sitting at a negotiating table with Iran when they are declaring publicly to everybody that they are en route to a nuclear bomb. You would think that would stop the negotiations. However, Iran sees this as a way of increasing their power at the negotiating table, because now there's something imminent. they need, or the West needs to relieve sanctions so that they stop producing a nuclear weapon. This is gloves off nuclear blackmail as we've never seen it with the Iranians.
It's a interesting combination of Iranian belligerence and their faith that other nations just aren't going to impose any kind of penalties on them for making these kinds of announcements or pursuing these kinds of activities. And it seems like to this point, they've just had a remarkable string of success in not facing consequences for these kinds of actions. And with Donald Trump out of the picture, it seems like they have a pretty free hand to do what they want to do.
Yeah, and I think that's what we are seeing that. And as we've written a lot of late, we are viewing these nuclear negotiations as really just a show in many ways, because we know that the Biden administration wants to re-enter a nuclear deal that does allow the Iranians access to international markets once again, bringing their whole economy onto the international stage so that it can function and can be equipped with the money that it needs to proceed with its international campaign of terror. And that's what the Bible actually prophesies the Iranians are going to do. The Bible calls the Iranian Empire, the Islamic Empire led from Iran, with other nations that are going to ally with it, the King of the South. And that's mentioned in Daniel 11, verse 40. And in that prophecy, it talks about how this King of the South pushes the world towards war. And we are seeing that. We are seeing the Iranians that push until they come to a place where somebody says, no, you're not going to push anymore, and actually uses force against them. That is the only language that the Iranians are going to understand. And the Biden administration, through this, has given no indication that it intends to scuttle the talks, because Iran is producing uranium, or is en route to producing uranium towards a nuclear weapon. In fact, it's just going to help provide the rationale for the Biden administration to get a deal signed quickly, as quickly as possible, to stop the Iranians. And what we know from history is that appeasing these type of powers that are bent on domination, such as the Iranians are, they only respond to force, not appeasement. And so going forward, I think what you'll expect is a quick wrap up to these nuclear talks with a new nuclear deal based on Iran's nuclear blackmail.
Where would you send people for more information, Brent?
People need to read The King of the South, this booklet by Mr. Gerald Flurry. It has a section in there about Iran's nuclear program and their desire to not just use it as a bargaining chip on the West, but actually to move towards a fully functional nuclear weapons program and to have a nuclear weapons arsenal.
Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. The race for who will become Germany's next chancellor after Angela Merkel steps down later this year just got more interesting. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
That's right. The leader of Germany's Christian Social Union officially threw his hat into the ring this week. That's Markus Söder. So in Germany's right wing, they have kind of this unusual situation where, instead of having one nationwide Republican Party or, you know, one nationwide right wing party, they have the Christian Democratic Union, the CDU, Angela Merkel's party, that runs in most of Germany. And then you have the CSU, the Christian Social Union, that runs only in the state of Bavaria, one of Germany's largest states, or I think it is the largest state. And the two of them work together. They unite behind a common candidate. Usually that candidate is the leader of the CDU. It's the bigger party. It's the bigger partner in that relationship. Every now and again, though, someone from the CSU will lead the ticket. And we've spoken previously a fair bit on this show about the vacuum in leadership at the head of the CDU, Angela Merkel stepping down. Her replacement has been less than spectacular. And so we've talked about how Markus Söder, the CSU leader, is the much more popular of the two. And so, but in the past, he's talked about not wanting to run, you know, the typical politician, I have no ambitions in that direction, et cetera, et cetera. This week, he officially stepped forward and said, no, I want the job. And you can kind of see why. They did a survey on these different leaders. And Laschet, the CDU leader, they asked Germans, how many of you people think that he has strong leadership? and 4% said that they thought Lechert had strong leadership.
And this is the one that the establishment politicians in Germany love this guy. They would love to see Laschet make it.
That's right. He is much more popular in the party itself, you know, with the politicians, not with the public, but with those like party members, members in parliament. They would prefer Laschet to lead them, I think. But then when people ask that same question about strong leadership about Söder, 60% said that they see Söder as a strong leader. To me, he's a bit of a comical figure, mostly because of the pictures that I tend to see of him usually show him either dressed up as Shrek or Marilyn Monroe. he does like dressing up. But it's really interesting to see this appetite and see some concrete. You know, we talk about how Germany wants a strong leader a fair bit. You're seeing a concrete evidence of that, with 60% saying that they want that they think he's a strong leader. Lots of people saying, well, actually, we do need this guy that is viewed as more decisive, that is viewed as viewed more strongly to be the replacer for Angela Merkel. Not Laschet, who's kind of more viewed as this consensus builder, someone who would be like Angela Merkel, a manager rather than a leader.
So the void of leadership within the CDU is opening the door for this kind of colorful politician from the CSU to step in. It certainly seems to be a whole lot more public appetite for that. What we're seeing is just more an environment and an atmosphere of disruption within German politics, and this could pave the way for more disruptions to come.
Yes, I think that's a great point. I mean, the CSU in general is viewed as kind of more hardline right. And so if a CSU leader is leading the ticket, that's a pretty clear step to the right for all of Germany's conservative leaders. You know, they're saying we want to put our rightmost foot forwards, to horribly mix those metaphors. So I think that's a significant step. That's a bit of a disruption to German politics. And I think it's also just really interesting because, you know, the Bible has a lot of specifics to say about European leadership. And we talked about this in the first half. And looking at what the Bible says, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has drawn attention to one German leader in particular who really seems to match that, the former German defense minister Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg, and that he could well be the strongman, and that is coming to Germany, and he leads in a tradition that comes from other people, Edmund Stoiber, Franz Josef Strauss. You've had a series of these men that have kind of mentored one after the other, that lead in that have this style of leadership. And if the party does end up going for Söder, it's kind of a step towards zu Gutenberg. It's a step towards his branch of the party. Somebody who's maybe a little bit more like him. There's still some fairly significant differences. And perhaps having a chancellor or a chancellor candidate from the CSU party, perhaps that could smooth the way and show even a smoother transition to this, you know, zu Gutenberg that is also in that Christian Social Union.
Well, we can definitely keep our eyes on this over this coming year as we anticipate these elections in September. And in the meantime, you can look at Gerald Fleury's booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, to become acquainted with these prophecies that we've been watching regarding German politics. Thank you for that, Richard. As America watches the trial of Derek Chauvin, the police officer involved in the death of George Floyd, racial tensions are soaring. More events this week that increased and stoked those tensions. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there have been protests almost every night this week in both Portland and Minneapolis over the death of Dante Wright. And I guess for the listeners who haven't been following that story, Dante Wright was a black man from Minneapolis. He was pulled over because the registration tag on his car had been expired. And then when the officers involved looked up his record, saw that he's actually wanted for aggravated assault. He robbed a woman at gunpoint. And so they moved to arrest him instead of just giving him a ticket for the expired tag. And then during that process, he attempted to run and was shot. Now, the officer pulled a gun and shot him, but that the time the witnesses were saying that they said that they're saying, I'm going to tase you. So it looks like they reached for her taser and pulled her gun instead. So she's been arrested for and charged with second degree manslaughter. I mean, she did kill a person as they were trying to escape. And I guess that'll come out in the trial if they figure out if it was if she meant to tase him, then that's definitely manslaughter. If she meant to shoot him, they can charge for murder. So those details are still coming out. But it's just really more of what the same we've seen so often in America over the last several months about these riots, and that, like, is almost similar to the George Floyd case, towards, like, yes, there may have been a wrongdoing during the arrest, but the officer's been arrested and charged, and you're still rioting for 4 or 5 nights in a row, leading to, like, many more people being arrested for destruction of property and things like that. It's like what are you what's your demand? It's like, I'm going to riot till they arrest you, I'm going to riot till they charge you, because, like, all that's already happened,
right? Yeah, and they already know the guilt of the individual involved without due process, without the law intervening, without any faith in law enforcement. Faith in law enforcement and trust in law enforcement is just at an abysmal low right now.
Right, and I mean, and that's really probably one of the worst things about this case, is that, I mean, there's definitely politicians with socialist political agendas that will jump right on this. I believe the representative from the Detroit region in Michigan, Rashida Tlaib, has already come out commenting on this case, showing that this shows that, like, the entire U.S. police system is systematically racist and has to be reformed, which is quite the claim to make. Because it's,
well,
like,
she actually said that it can't be reformed; it's impossible to reform because it's so inherently racist.
Yeah, well, I guess you must. I don't even know what she's calling for, like, abolish it, but yeah, like, systematically racist. Because it's like, all right, you've got 700,000 police officers across the nation, or more than that, actually a little bit more than that. So I don't necessarily follow how one incident implicates 700,000 people. And even in, like, said, the one incident, they haven't produced evidence so far that race had anything to do with it. It just seemed like an officer really addled to find out that it was a female officer trying to arrest someone who had been already charged with robbing at gunpoint and then pulled her own gun instead of her taser. But yeah, you'll do see this. We'll put in the show notes, our editor-in-chief had an article titled War on Police that he wrote back in the wake of some of the Baltimore riots that really talks about how a lot of these politicians, Rashida Tlaib being one of them, aren't really trying to solve the problem. They're stirring up race resentment for political reasons, either to get votes or in many cases to try to pressure the federal government to be able to take over local police departments, creating, like, a national police state. And there's a myriad of political motivations politicians have for this, whether they're trying to get reelection or take over the police departments or in some cases even just create chaos in the nation, that you've got to tear down the old system before you can build up a new one. But then Mr. Flory, he points out in that article that they're really stirring up in so many cases problems worse than they intend to solve and probably worse than they anticipate.
Right.
Like I say, Isaiah 1:7 talks about, like, cities burning with fire, that, like, you start getting this convincing huge portions of the population that the police are systematically racist and can't be reformed. Now, you might say that because there's something specific you want, but once you convince enough people that's true, I mean, this rioting just continues. And then, like, even if Rashida Tlaib would come out and tell people to stop rioting, that may not happen.
Police Under Attack is the title of the article from Gerald Fleury. We'll link to it in our show notes, and thank you for that, Andrew. We'll finish with a story about intellectual property theft, something that China regularly does without hesitation. Evidence shows how this has been the formula for the success of China's technology company, Huawei. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, Huawei is a Chinese company that makes phones and telecommunications equipment. It's basically China's Apple, but even larger. It's the world's largest telecommunications company. And there's a new report by Mind Matters that details just how much of Huawei's technology is stolen from the U.S. and other Western nations. So it goes into some detail about intellectual property that Huawei stole from a Canadian telecommunications firm called Nortel. The report also talks about their theft from Ericsson, which is a Swedish telecommunications company. And then it spends most of its time on Huawei stealing caches of trade secrets and intellectual property from numerous American companies. So T-Mobile and Cisco Technology have both been just, you know, plundered. In the case of Cisco, Huawei not only stole mountains of software and router technology, they even plagiarized their user manuals. You know, spelling errors and everything were right there in the plagiarized Huawei manuals. And then also Motorola and CNX Labs and Quintel, one of the key ingredients of China's famous 5G technology was stolen from Quintel. And then the list just goes on and on. And in many cases, what China stole from these companies does a great deal of direct harm to them. In the case of Nortel, for example, it was world famous for several years and just a lead player in telecommunications. But after Huawei stole their intellectual property and reverse engineered it and then sold those same products cheaper than Nortel could, Nortel actually had to file for bankruptcy. And they never really recovered from that. So it's just, you know, a nauseating amount of theft that's happening here. For the U.S. alone, all of China's stealing is believed to cost up to $600 billion every year. So just a staggering amount. And I think it should actually come as no surprise, because we've seen over the years that the Chinese Communist Party will kill and lie and steal and do anything that they think is necessary to get ahead.
Yeah, that's a great point. You put this together with all of the other news that continually emerges from China. You get a very consistent picture of just the amorality of that regime. Looking at this prophetically, why would you consider this important?
Well, there's actually a chapter, Deuteronomy 28, and it mentions some specific ways that God would bless Israel, primarily meaning the modern U.S. and Britain, if they obeyed him. And it also details some specific ways that he would punish those countries if they refused to turn to him. And in verse 33, it says one of those specific ways that he would punish them is that the fruits of their labor would be stolen and consumed by an outside power. So this is exactly what's happening. America is rejecting God. That's easy to see. And as a result, God is letting the fruits of U.S. labor, you know, all kinds of the country's most valuable technology, he's letting that be stolen and consumed by a foreign power, exactly as he warned that he would. But we can actually end on a little bit of a high note here, because the same Bible that accurately foretold modern America having its fruits and labors devoured by an enemy nation also says that this kind of thievery will not be allowed to go on indefinitely. Isaiah 65, verses 21 through 23, talk about a time in the future when earth will be under God's government instead of man's government. And it specifically says that systematic theft, like the type that Huawei and other arms of the Chinese government engage in today, will be a thing of the past. So this, it just gives us a deeply inspiring picture of the future. And if any listeners would like to understand more about not just China's role in Bible prophecy, but also the time beyond that, when there's real peace and justice, I would recommend Mr. Fleury's book, Isaiah's End Time Vision.
Okay, thank you, Jeremiah. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Franklin P. Jones. The trouble with being punctual is that nobody's there to appreciate it. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
To Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.